Good morning. This is Elliot Nagin. I'm the media director here at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Thanks for joining our call this morning. Just to remind you, the Union of Concerned Scientists is an independent, science-based advocacy group that has been a nuclear industry watchdog for 40 years. We are not for or against nuclear power. Our goal has always been to ensure that the industry operates in the safest manner possible. If we do not get to your question today during our briefing, please email us at media@ucsusa.org. We will respond as soon as possible. Please do not contact our experts directly. We have been overwhelmed with requests for interviews, and unfortunately, we don't have the capacity to respond to everyone. If you have trouble getting down everything that you need from today's briefing, there will be a transcript and an audio file on our website later today. I wanted to give you a heads up for this weekend. We will host a telephone briefing on Saturday and Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, featuring one or more of our experts. But because we've been working 7 days and nights straight, we are cutting back media availability over the weekend. As I said, we will host a briefing at 11 a.m. on Saturday and Sunday, but our experts will not be available otherwise until Monday, so we will not be taking media requests this weekend. Next week, we will continue to hold 11 a.m. telephone briefings until further notice, and on Monday, we will resume handling your requests throughout the day. Now, as for today's press briefing, when asking a question this morning, please state your name and news organization. Please ask only one question and, if necessary, one follow-up. And please mute your phone after you ask your question. Otherwise, the sound of your typing will make it difficult for everyone else to hear. Today, we are featuring David Lockbaum to talk about the latest developments in Japan. David is the director of our nuclear safety program. He is a nuclear engineer who worked at U.S. nuclear plants for 17 years, including three that are similar to the General Electric plants in Japan. He has also worked as a safety trainer for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Yesterday, we released a new report by David on the safety record of the U.S. nuclear industry in 2010. Also on the line is Ellen Vanko, our Nuclear Energy and Climate Change Project Manager. Ellen has more than 25 years of experience working in the electric utility industry, and she can answer your questions on the impact this disaster could have on the nuclear industry here in the United States. We also hope that Dr. Edwin Lyman, a senior scientist in the U.S. Global Security Program, will be able to join us. Ed has been delayed, unfortunately, and we hope he'll be able to join us later for your questions. Ed has a doctorate in physics and is an expert on nuclear plant design and the environmental and health effects of radiation. I now give you David Lockbaum.
Thank you, Elliot, and good morning. The information I'll be covering in my presentation today has been posted to our website and should be available to supplement what I'll say this morning. I'd like to talk this morning about the possible causes of the reactor building explosions in Japan. Dramatic videos have shown the explosions that severely damaged the reactor buildings at first Unit 1 and then Unit 3 at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant in Japan. The explosions are attributed to the ignition of hydrogen gas that collected within the reactor buildings. The hydrogen was most likely produced by damaged fuel rods in the reactor core. To reduce pressure in the reactor vessel, some of that hydrogen was released from the vessel into the primary containment structure around the reactor. A key unsolved riddle is how a significant amount of hydrogen escaped from the primary containment into the reactor building, and how this low probability event could have happened twice in two different reactors. The Japanese reactors are boiling water reactors that feature Mark I containment designs. In this design, the reactor core is housed within a metal reactor vessel. The reactor vessel is enclosed within the primary containment structure, and the reactor building completely surrounds the containment structure. The reactor building walls are made of 18 to 30 inch thick concrete up to the elevation of the refueling platform. The walls are made of metal from that elevation to the building's roof. The hydrogen gas most likely came from a chemical reaction between the water and the metal cladding of the fuel rods within the reactor cores when the water level inside the reactor vessels dropped low enough to expose at least the upper core regions. The hydrogen gas initially collected in the reactor vessel itself. To cool the fuel inside the reactor, workers attempted to pump seawater into the reactor vessel. As pressure inside the reactor vessel increased, it kept water from flowing easily into the reactor. Periodically, then, workers opened valves to vent steam and gas from the reactor vessel into the pressure suppression chamber, also called the torus. The gas, including hydrogen, collected in the airspace above the torus water and was periodically equalized with the airspace in the dry well, the other portion of the primary containment structure. When the pressure in the containment, which was the combination of the dry well and the torus, rose too high, workers vented the containment to the atmosphere. This vent piping passed through the reactor building, but discharged outside of it. The destruction of the Unit 1 and Unit 3 reactor buildings appeared to have been caused by hydrogen explosions. As noted above, an unanswered question is how the hydrogen got into the reactor building. A little-known test performed decades ago at the Brunswick nuclear plant in North Carolina may be the answer to that question. In the 70s, in order to satisfy a requirement in the American Society of Mechanical Engineers code for prototype containment designs, workers performed a structural integrity test on the reactor at Brunswick. The primary containment structure at Brunswick was designed to withstand an internal pressure of 62 pounds per square inch, PSI. The ASME code required it to be tested at 71 pounds per square inch to show margin to what the design called for. It's important to note that this test was only performed on the prototype containments. Subsequent containment designs were only tested to the design pressure, not the higher pressure level. The test involved pumping air into the containment structure until the pressure rose to 71 pounds per square inch. The pumps were then turned off and the pressure monitored for several hours to verify that it didn't drop off, which would demonstrate that the containment was intact. During that time, workers would also record data from strain gauges and other instruments to verify that the structural loads were properly distributed within the containment. But as workers increased the containment pressure, they encountered a problem at Brunswick. The pressure stopped increasing and remained constant at 70 pounds per square inch. The pumps continued to push air into the containment, but its pressure just stopped increasing. This unexpected plateau started a hunt for air leaking from the containment building somewhere. Workers heard a hissing sound at the top of the containment structure. They found air leaking through the drywall flange area. The drywall head is made of metal, and it's bolted to the metal top of the drywall bottom, the bottom half of it. These two metal parts have come together and are sealed by a rubber O-ring at the flange to provide a good fit when it's bolted to the top of the drywall. What workers found was that the containment pressure of 70 pounds per square inch was pushing upward against the inner dome of the drywall head and lifting it off of the drywall flange up against the bolts. And that was providing a pathway for air to leak out of containment. This air leaked into an area called the refueling cavity, which is just above the drywall head. This refueling cavity is located inside the reactor building, outside of primary containment. At Brunswick, the workers tightened down the drywall head bolts to more securely fit the reactor vessel or the drywall head to the top of the drywall bottom. That reduced the leak rate and allowed the test to pressure to go up to 71 pounds per square inch. The test was successfully completed. While other plants conduct pressure tests initially and periodically thereafter to verify the containment integrity, those tests are not performed at such a high pressure. They're performed at the lower design pressure. As at Brunswick, with the pressure at the design pressure, the drywall head did not lift off the flange, and this leakage path was not created. So this was a very unique test performed in Brunswick, and the lessons learned from that test experience were not widely shared with the rest of the industry here in the United States and elsewhere. But how does this Brunswick containment testing experience relate to the reactor building explosions experienced in Japan? Workers at those reactors faced significant problems cooling the reactor cores. The combined effects of the earthquake and tsunami left the reactor without its normal electrical power and the backup. When the third backup, the batteries, were lost, all cooling systems were exhausted, and workers turned to the only remaining option, injecting seawater into the reactor vessels to try to cool the reactor cores. The pumps used to send seawater into the reactor vessel operated at low pressure. When seawater entered the reactor vessel, it was heated up by the hot reactor cores to the point of boiling. Steam produced by the boiling increased the pressure inside the reactor vessel. To prevent this rising pressure from hindering the seawater makeup rates, workers periodically vented the reactor vessel. This carried steam and gas, including hydrogen, into the containment. This flow in turn increased the pressure inside the containment. When the containment pressure rose too high, workers vented the containment to the atmosphere. The workers promptly sought to minimize the containment venting to the atmosphere to lessen the amount of radioactivity that was being released from the containment structure. Therefore, they were waiting as long as possible before venting. They allowed the pressure to rise up close to 70 pounds per square inch. It is possible that the containment pressures rose high enough to replicate the Brunswick experience by lifting the drywall head enough to allow hydrogen and other gases to leak into the refueling cavity and reactor building. If so, hydrogen could very easily have built up to explosive mixtures. This tragedy will closely examined for its causes, what happened and why. That scrutiny must determine how hydrogen got into the reactor buildings to cause the catastrophic explosions. The drywall head pathway may be that answer. We need to stress that this, we're not putting this forward as the only answer for this question, but it's the most plausible explanation that we've heard today. Thank you.